This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Welcome to Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeline Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, You Fancy Me Mad, Renfield, Lear and Ophelia, Madness in Speculative Fiction.
I feel like we should start this episode with just a long soliloquy from Edgar Allan Poe, but we probably don't have time for that.
No, and, you know, that might turn people off, because Edgar Allan Poe's one of those Marmite writers.
He definitely is, but I did feel like we couldn't do an episode about madness without drawing on the Telltale Heart.
Yes.
Which is a very frequently studied piece of Gothic fiction and short story. I kind of want to start the episode by talking about the Telltale Heart, because, yeah, Edgar Allan Poe is definitely a Marmite writer. And I mean, what do you think of the Telltale Heart?
And that's a weird one. I really liked it back as a teenager, and then I reread it again recently, and I thought, actually, Edgar Allan Poe's kind of a piss artist when it comes to writing. As in, I don't think he ever got to the stage, because he died young.
Yeah.
And there's some mysterious stuff going on around his death as well.
Mm-hmm.
And then all the tragedy that beset his life as well. I feel like he never really got into his second gear, so it's good, and nobody's ever seen it before.
Yeah.
But at the same time, there was... The Telltale Heart actually felt slightly immature in terms of its writing. Its themes were really interesting.
Yeah.
Because you have the narrator who, ultimately, he cannot deal with the fact that he is looking at his own possible future when he cares for this old man.
Yeah.
He finds him frightening and villainous and persuades himself this man is evil. He actually hits one of my six classic Gothic madness tropes, which I'll explain a bit later, which leads to him, obviously, if you haven't read the story, killing the man and burying him under the floorboards of the house.
Yeah.
And everything seems to be going fine until the police call one evening, and the young caretaker swears he can hear the heart beating through the floorboards. Ultimately, it's the sound of his own guilt. That's what makes him confess to the police and say, you know, I murdered him. Obviously, I'm paraphrasing here. But the narrator of that story, the young man, ultimately is in a dissociative state for the entire story.
He is. And the thing that interests me about the Telltale Heart is the justification that the narrator uses to explain why he killed this old man. And very early on, you know, he says, I loved the old man.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, he is a caretaker, he's taking care of him. We don't know the relationship between the two, whether they're related or anything like that. I mean, there's a lot of theories that there was a homosexual relationship there as well. You know, there's a lot of, you know, that it was repressed homosexual feelings that caused the madness. And yeah, there's all sorts of stuff that they talk about. But the fact that he says, I love the old man, but it was his evil eye. And it was just the fact that this old man had this eye. And it was the eye that the caretaker obsessed over and just couldn't. And as far as, you know, it was the center of all evil for him. And he had to get rid of it. And he had to kill the old man because of it. And then he spends the entire short story basically saying, but I'm not crazy. Obviously, I'm not crazy. And if I tell you how I killed the old man, you'll see I'm not crazy. I'm a genius, you know.
Yeah.
And that he isn't crazy. He's just his senses are so honed in that, you know, he was like slightly overwhelmed and things like that. And he describes how doing these absolutely batshit crazy things. And then saying, see, I'm clearly not crazy. And it was very interesting because, you know, that they do talk about, there's that saying, which is that if you're mad, you don't know you're mad.
Yeah.
And also, you know, there's the definition of madness is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. There's all these sayings. I don't know how much we can put into them, but there is this repetition within the story where he keeps just doing the same thing. And he talks about, you know, he had this lantern and he sort of he'd open the light a little bit so that it would shine on the evil eye. And we don't really know why, what he was planning, what he was really doing each time he snuck into the old man's room. And the fact that he was watching the old man sleep, and it was only when the old man woke up that is when he flew in and killed him. So what was his original plan?
Yeah, good question. I guess we don't really know, obviously, but to me, a lot of the hallmarks of that, if you want to look at it from a more sort of modern-day realistic perspective, perhaps,
yeah,
is the fact that you have somebody doing a full-time caring job for somebody else who clearly can't look after themselves.
Yeah.
Those situations wear you down, even when you love the person. And he was isolated. We don't know that anybody else ever really came round, or he didn't really get a break.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, as you say, he obsessed. It seemed to me he entered some sort of dissociative state for most of that entire story.
Yeah.
He had that entire cognitive dissonance where he's trying to say, well, I loved him, but, you know, I also killed him. And those two things sit together well. It's like, well, they don't really, do they?
Yeah.
And then add to that the fact that, you know, I think his isolation and his sense of obsession just caused a full-on psychotic break. And I'm not a psychologist or a psychiatrist. This is just basically from, you know, if we're going to read it as anything other than a piece of short, lurid fiction.
Yeah. We can. Yeah, and I tend to agree with you that's what it was. And the interesting thing is that the kind of the falling back on almost supernatural forces to explain his actions, to justify his actions. The reason it's an interesting story, of course, is you could look at it from a completely different point of view. Now, I'm going to say the word, I'm going to bring up fairies. I'm sorry, we can't talk about madness and not talk about fairies.
No, that's fair.
In that there was this long, there's always been a very long relationship between the supernatural and madness, or, you know, sort of insanity. One only has to look at hallucinations and say, you know, before we understood that this was caused by something going funky in your brain. If you started hallucinating, of course you were going to think it was the fairies playing a trick on you. Or that, you know, God was sending a message. You know, it depends who you were. If you're a woman, you're a witch. But if you're a man, then possibly it's God. Sorry, I'm not bitter. I'm so bitter, Jules. I'm so bitter.
To be fair, it could be that, you know, it really depends who you manage to get to listen to you as well.
Yeah, this is true.
To the person who followed the madman.
Exactly. So there has always been this very long relationship. And I will talk about a little bit later about a particular Victorian artist who painted fairies a lot, but from the inside of an asylum, having killed his father and all sorts of stuff like that. So we'll talk about him a little bit later. But if you, the interesting thing about the Telltale Heart is that the use of the word the evil eye, which does actually, you know, correspond with certain mythologies.
Yeah.
And again, we think about the time that it was written, we think about the empire, we think about the fact that this was a time of great mysticism when a lot of the occult became very popular. We were assimilating a lot of foreign cultures and superstitions and beliefs into our own mixed form of occultism and mysticism.
The whole evil eye thing, there is a centuries old folklore tradition of overlooking somebody, as in you cross a witch's path or a sorcerer's path and they give you the evil eye, which means they're overlooking you, that they're placing some sort of guise or curse on you.
Yeah.
That exists in vernacular even today. If you say to someone, don't give me evils, the idea is that they're sort of squinting at you because they disapprove of what you're doing. But that's a shortening of don't give me the evil eye because you don't like what I'm doing.
Exactly. And so, the evil eye was in itself a form of curse, which something like a Nazar, those Arabian, you know, or specifically you get them in Turkey and stuff like that, of those little charms, which are the blue glass circles, and then there's a white circle, and then there's another blue and a little black dot.
Yeah.
And they protect you, Nazars protect you from the evil eye. So I've always got one handy, because you never know.
Do you upset a lot of people on a regular basis, Madeline?
I mean, yeah. My general presence is quite offensive to a lot of people. but, yeah, so the use of the particular term of the evil eye brings in this element of the supernatural. And if you reread the story with a supernatural element to it as well, it completely turns it on its head.
I'm waiting for you to walk me through that because I'm not sure I agree.
Well, I mean, the reason I say this is obviously I taught this piece for rewriting and adapting module. So we were rewriting and adapting the stories. You bring it that actually the old man was some form of sorcerer, or that there was a supernatural force in place, and that the caretaker wasn't actually crazy. He's actually being quite sincere, or if he was crazy, he became crazy, but he wasn't inherently mad. The madness wasn't what caused his reaction. The madness was an effect of an act he was forced to commit by another greater force.
Okay, I can see it. I'm not sure I buy it, because it doesn't for me fit with the rest of the text.
No, but as I said, it's just a form of perspective. I don't think that that was the intention at all. I just think that it's very interesting that the supernatural and madness have such a strong link with one another. And we see it being used in a number of other films. And how often, you know, do we get that in speculative fiction where everyone's like, well, look, no, you're crazy. It's like, I'm not crazy. I really am being chased by demons, or, you know, something like that. And it is interesting that from an outside perspective, if the supernatural is in play within a speculative fiction, within speculative fiction, rather, if the supernatural is in play, from the outside of that, if you do not believe in the supernatural, if you are not within the know of the supernatural, behaviours which make total sense to the reader and the protagonist, because of the supernatural, will be perceived as madness.
Yes, or certainly outside the range of normality.
Yeah.
Perhaps it's a good place to, because we've sort of dived right in rather than set out our stool and explain why exactly we're on the subject. Yeah, madness is an umbrella term reflecting various states of a person's departure from the norm. And certainly when you look at Gothic fiction, that's the case. Gothic fiction has this slightly, almost incestuous relationship with the idea of madness, because most Gothic fiction was written at a time when the age of reason was dawning. You know, we had the Industrial Revolution happening, and the spiritualist movement was considered a form of science in a way.
Yeah.
So the idea of there being genuine supernatural magic type, you know, circumstances were unpalatable to that sort of audience. But in order to keep the unknown within the sort of text, madness was a shorthand for being able to do that.
Yeah.
Because it wasn't understood. With the supernatural, you don't always have to give a reason. Certainly if you look at, say, M.R. James's ghost stories or The Turn of the Screw, things like that, if you claim one of the characters is mad, or you show them to be that far outside the norms, then you don't have to walk your reader through exactly what's happening, and perhaps you don't have to explain. So I'm not sure there's so much laziness there, but it was easier to leave it open-ended so that they got the same feeling you get from having the supernatural in a piece of writing without actually saying, it's supernatural, I'm writing fantasy, guys, because it was not fashionable.
I do like that. It's just they're like, madness was basically shorthand for I can do what I want.
Yeah. And I think the trouble is, I suppose that was almost acceptable at the time, because you might pity somebody who could be classed as mad, or you might vilify them, but it was outside the ken of man at the time. Even the best doctors didn't really understand. So it was kind of okay to other them. But the problem is it's something that's stayed as shorthand and persisted and followed us into modern narratives as well, where it really doesn't have a place.
Yeah.
So going back to Gothic fiction, let's look at the different types of madness, because this is kind of fun. Some of the terms I'm going to use weren't actually used during the 18th and 19th centuries, because they just didn't have them. But if you look at the descriptions, that's clearly what they're describing. And I find it really interesting that you can have books from the 18th and 19th centuries that clearly describe these states that are recognised psychologically now, even though they didn't have the words for them. So, first of all, you have delusion, which you've touched on, obviously. So delusion, the idea of hallucinating, seeing something that other people can't see. This is a component of the ghost story.
Yeah.
You know, it's almost a staple. You almost have to have it in there. One person can see the ghost and the other people can't, kind of thing.
Yeah.
Then you have dissociation. That's a trickier one to show. But if you think of things like, yeah, probably the turn of the screw, where the governess really does think that the children are possessed by demons. And it, part of that is to, you know, dissociation goes hand in hand with one of the other stages, which I'll mention in a minute. But you also see it in things like Dracula, you see it in things like Frankenstein, you see it in various other bits of Gothic fiction. You even see it in Moby Dick, actually, thinking about it, which isn't Gothic fiction at all. Another component, you have depression. Depression shows up a lot in Gothic fiction. Usually it's a result of either a physical illness, or it's a result of things that are happening that can't be explained, and the character feels they're being punished, which is actually a component of depression as we understand it in modern terms. But at the time, depression was very much a case of, well, this is kind of like the wheel rim of madness, you know? You're on the outside of it. You mustn't let yourself go down any further. You must keep your spirits up. After that, this is an interesting one. Dissipation. If you drink too much and go out sleeping with lots of people, there's a good chance you're going to put yourself in a physical or mental state where you're unhealthy. It was recognised to be unhealthy to just sort of give yourself up to it. And, you know, if you look at a lot of the Bronte novels, the characters who become dissipated quite often do genuinely come down with actual madness in Gothic terms. The fifth one is distance, which sounds insane, but it's a real component with the Gothic hero rather than the heroine. The Gothic hero hits a snag, is divided from the heroine, perhaps forever, and this distance forms a kind of madness itself, where he starts to act perhaps a little out of character. This sort of goes hand in hand with the depression, and sometimes the dissipation stage.
Right.
And finally, the sixth one is obsession. Obsession is the massive component with all with madness in Gothic fiction, where the madman or woman is actually a villain and becomes vilified. If you think of Dracula, if you think of Frankenstein, if you think of the mysterious case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, and even things like the Moonstone at the Telltale Heart is another one. Obsession goes hand in hand with the dissociative state. And you could say, if you look back at some of these examples of Gothic fiction, that the character has suffered a massive psychotic break.
Yeah.
Just for reference, obviously I've said I don't have a psychology degree, but someone who suffers a psychotic break, basically what that means is they've departed from reality as everybody else understands it. And it's usually a brief thing. Most people will have at least one psychotic break in their lifetime. So it sounds awful, but it's actually not quite as bad to our modern understanding as people think. No, genuinely, it really isn't. It's not a good thing. But the trouble is, we put lots of pressure on ourselves, lots of stresses that we're not really meant to deal with. If you think of most of us being in jobs we're not happy in, that constant stress, if it's something you're actively unhappy with as well, that constant stress, we're not supposed to exist in a state of constant stress. We're not supposed to exist with our fight or flight reaction constantly engaged. And that can lead to a full-on psychotic break. That's not the same as saying psychopathy or being psychopathic. You know, it's a completely different thing. But I think the trouble is the terms sound the same, so people muddle them up.
Yeah.
What it really means is you've departed from reality briefly. In layman's terms.
Just briefly.
Well, just I say for briefly, a short time. maybe a couple of months or something. But that can be a result. You know, when we talk in Gothic fiction of the balance of her mind was affected by grief.
Yeah.
That's what they're talking about. They're talking about a psychotic break. So there you go. Those are Jules' six classifications for Gothic madness.
Thank you, Jules.
delusion, dissociation, depression, dissipation, distance, obsession, possibly leading to a psychotic break. Ta-da!
If you've been feeling any of these things, please
put down those 19th century novels for a start.
Oh, you think that'll help?
I just realised how many of them begin with D. That's quite
the three the D's.
Da, 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 da.
It is odd that, you know, in talking about madness, well, I mean, it's not odd, we've already established why, but we're just going back to those 19th century novels. There's just so many of them.
Yeah.
Wuthering Heights. Well, I mean, the Bronte sisters were all over that, so.
Yeah, I mean, Jane Eyre. I suppose the thing with, yeah, Jane Eyre's a really good one to talk about, actually, but yeah, the Brontes particularly, Wuthering Heights. Let's look at how many mad people are in that. Because Cathy runs mad. So does Heathcliff. You could argue Hindley does. Hindley does it the classic dissipation route, where he literally drinks himself to death almost.
Yeah.
Their father, Mr. Earnshaw, it's not, you know, it goes hand in hand with what is clearly alcoholism or drug dependency, because, you know, there's a bit of, like, laudanum use going on there as well.
Yeah.
It's not surprising that Emily Bronte would put that in there, because at the time she was she was helping her father to care for her brother Branwell, who was suffering a severe laudanum and drink addiction.
Yeah.
And made several suicide attempts. So, again, it turns up in Jane Eyre as well. You've got the wife in the attic, Bertha Mason, and she is. It's made very clear that it isn't Rochester hates her because she's mad. He hates her because she cheated on him, ruined his good name, went round just literally making a complete fool of him and lied about everything pre-marriage, and so did her family, and then turned out to be mad on top of that. So he had very little sympathy left for her when she got to that stage.
Yeah.
And yet he still had her treated well. I mean, when people, like, yeah, it's not ideal. You know what, is shutting your wife up in the attic and pretending she doesn't exist is not ideal. But compared to some of the asylums on offer at the time,
yeah,
it is actually a much kinder thing to do.
Yeah, but still.
yeah, but I mean, let's bear in mind, the few scenes where we actually see Bertha Mason, the first time, every time it's violence. I mean, the first time she is trying to burn Rochester alive in his bed.
Yeah.
The second time she has just attacked her brother with a knife and her teeth and tried to suck blood out of his chest.
Yeah.
The time after that, she's managed to get into Jane's room and started ripping up her wedding clothes. And then the time after that, she sets fire to the entire house before jumping off the roof. So this is not a well woman at all. This is not someone in possession of her wits. And, you know, we don't know exactly what was wrong. And I'm pretty sure Charlotte Bronte didn't have a psychology degree, since psychology didn't exist and women weren't allowed to attend university when she was writing it. So basically she was just going off hearsay, and you can see where they were influenced. You can see that the Brontes were influenced by lurid tales of Lord Byron and what he got up to and what he wrote, and by Sir Walter Scott. Well, you can. It's all there. It's very noticeable that Emily and Charlotte both include these Byronic pyrotechnics in their writing, which Anne doesn't.
I just love Byron. It's just Byron in general.
It's clearly Byron.
Sorry. And then you have Mary Shelley.
Going back in time, you have Mary Shelley. since we're talking about Byron, we may as well go on to Frankenstein.
Yes. Now, madness actually does feature in Frankenstein as well, because Frankenstein, the scientist, the creator, not the monster, has a psychotic break for a short while, and is cared for by his friend, because he gets very physically and mentally unwell. And actually, the interesting thing is that this is that was the first time when I first read the novel that I actually saw an instance of madness being caused by stress.
Yeah.
In that Frankenstein became obsessed with creating this creature, and when he succeeded, it wasn't quite what he what he planned. And he literally just, it was the fight or flight instinct that kicked in that he obsessed over this to the point of complete ill health, and then had a total breakdown. He'd also isolated himself from everybody. He was going through some things, and he had this breakdown. And the way that it was written was actually very realistic, I feel.
Yeah.
In that it really, really did touch down on that mass anxiety and paranoia and stress in a very realistic way, which wasn't that common when writers were talking about madness during that day, during the day and age. But this felt quite real, and it's possibly linked to some of the things that Mary Shelley herself went through.
Yeah, I mean, the interesting thing there, you're absolutely right. Obviously, brief history of Mary Shelley. She was an incredibly educated woman. She ran off with Percy Shelley, who was married to somebody else already, at the age of sort of 16. At 17, she was pregnant and gave birth to a daughter. The daughter died before she was more than a year and a half old. And Mary Shelley was in quite understandably a depressive state for a while after that.
Yeah.
She couldn't marry Percy Shelley because he was married and there was no divorce.
And worse than that, Percy Shelley's wife at that point then also gave birth to a healthy baby boy.
Yes, which obviously would not have helped at all. And Percy Shelley took Mary Shelley off to Geneva, to Villa Diodati, where they stayed with Byron. Well, actually they didn't. They stayed in a separate villa, but sometimes the storms on Lake Geneva were so bad they couldn't actually cross the lake to get back to their own villa at night. So there was one particular evening where they stayed with Byron, along with, what was her name? Claire Clermont.
Yeah.
Who was Byron's cast-off mistress, and John Polidori, who was Byron's personal physician. It was all about Byron. No, kind of noticed.
Everything's all about Byron. He was very...
but anyway, despite the fact that you had... generally, this was a group of really intelligent people, despite the moral turpitude of the time, and the fact that their conversations, particularly... In that year, which was the year called the Year Without a Summer, because one of the volcanoes had erupted and a lot of ash was in the atmosphere, which meant that quite often the sun seemed to set around about lunchtime. So the days were very short in the summer. and, you know, the crops didn't get harvested. This was part of the petty ice age that happened.
Yeah. You
know, that was sort of one of the really big lows of it. Everything was very cold and very stormy.
I just love the petty ice age. Not a real ice age, it was just being petty.
Well, you see, mammoths didn't start sweeping down from the north. but yeah, you can see how that and the depressive state, having lost her child and at such a young age, despite how intelligent and educated she was, that might have affected. She found something to channel it into with her writing, ultimately. And I think that does come out in Frankenstein, because what parent who hasn't lost a child doesn't think, if I could just bring them back?
Yeah.
And I think perhaps that's what comes out. And certainly talking about Frankenstein's dissociative depressive state himself, as you say, it reads realistically. This is someone who's experienced it.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I think it was, you know... We've talked about Frankenstein in the past and sort of its themes and what it's really about, and the sort of the fear of medical, of sort of the progression that was happening at the time. But with Mary Shelley is that it does come onto that other side, is that she understands Frankenstein's obsession. And Mary Shelley, by all accounts, was not only herself probably suffering from several mental health issues during the time, and that she definitely was depressed. She was surrounded by other people who were suffering from that as well.
Yeah, certainly Byron was not the most stable of people. Percy Shelley had depression, probably.
Yeah,
we don't know because nobody diagnosed them at the time. But
no, but we have several cases of suicide within Shelley's within Mary Shelley's family alone.
Yeah.
And in the surrounding area. This was a time that people were not well. They were not well. It wasn't diagnosed. And so she really, really managed to capture that in Frankenstein. And Frankenstein, for me, is also seems to be her answer to her depression, which is that she talks about recreating this lost love, you know, this child that she lost, but then basically reasons with herself that that would be an abomination.
Yeah.
And it's almost therapeutic in some ways, except it's not, because Frankenstein never is always haunted by his mistake forever.
Yeah.
And is chased by it. And you can understand why some of the sympathy for the creature comes into it, because she was channeling that this was her child. This was her little one. And it's desperately sad, but also creates possibly for me one of the best depictions of madness and obsession in that period of time.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Frankenstein is often partnered with the other sort of monster books, if you like.
Yeah.
Madness is more of a passing theme in Dracula.
Yeah.
But there's different types of it, so I think it's worth looking at. I mean, obviously, Jonathan Harker suffers a violent brain fever, which is a nervous breakdown.
Yeah. And which you can kind of understand.
Which you can kind of understand, because a psychotic break or a nervous breakdown is usually a reaction to severe trauma or persistent and continued stress that we're just not designed to deal with.
Yeah.
But you also have Dr. Van Helsing, who is clearly obsessed. He's an obsessive person about this one monster.
Yeah.
Dracula himself. And then there's Paul Renfield.
Oh, Renfield.
Renfield, who is utterly repugnant, you know, it's very difficult to feel sympathy for him, but at the same time, it's not his fault he's there. That's what a different mind to Jonathan Harker's would have been like. Over, you know, completely taken over by a much stronger personality, to the point where he's gone past the point of brainwashing, I think. His entire worldview has been completely altered by this traumatic encounter. Encounter, oh dear.
No, Jules!
So bad.
No!
Yeah, and there's just not the help. He's shut up in this awful asylum. And yeah, it's difficult to feel any sympathy for Renfield, because Renfield almost has this sort of Stockholm syndrome going on.
Yeah.
Where he wants to be with the master. But yeah, so Dracula does, you know, Bram Stoker's actually sort of pasted madness all over the pages without it being directly about madness. And then at the end, Jonathan Harker actually says, "We've all been God's madmen."
Yeah.
Which is a case of, you know, we have spent so long hunting this creature, we have lost sight of the fact that we're men, you know?
Yeah.
We are humans. We've let go of our essential humanity. So that's an interesting thought. Then you've got The Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde.
Yeah.
Which I won't go into. I have to say, as a novella, as any piece of writing, I don't love that book greatly.
No. And I think actually probably one of the things that sort of frustrates me with it is that the fact that it's kind of used as shorthand schizophrenia.
Yeah, and that's clearly not what it was, because there is an element of choice going on there, because Dr. Jekyll really was quite mild-mannered and intelligent, but at the same time obsessed, that obsessive characteristic where he had to know, which leads him to create the formula that basically releases his baser nature. And there's some horrible stuff going on there. There's some serious like sexualization of unwilling women and some abuse of prostitutes. And that's before all the murders start happening.
Yeah.
So yeah, while I think it does sort of embrace the idea that there's the potential for evil in all of us, people using it as a shorthand for like this bipolar disorder or schizophrenia, it's uncomfortable in that respect.
Yeah.
The one I want to talk about, though, is Phantom of the Opera.
Ah, yes.
Not the musical.
Oh.
the musical's a much more coherent story. If you read the book by Gaston, it's nuts. It's like, I was thinking, how many drugs were you doing when you wrote this? The book is all over the shop. It's really mad. But the Phantom himself, this awful, terribly deformed person who used to be part of a freak show and then was part of the Sultana's... he was like special entertainment for the Sultana. He tortured people for her for fun.
Yeah.
And he came up with the most creative ways of doing it. He is a genius. He really is that clever.
Mm.
But he's so far off the scale that he has taken that departure from acceptable normality to the point where, when you put that hand in hand with madness and his dissociative insistence that he can have Christine Daae, he's mad. You know, mad's a box of frogs in Gothic terms.
Yes.
So, I mean, I think they even mention in the book, genius has turned to madness, which is something that gets quoted a lot.
Yeah.
The idea is that genius is next to madness because it's that same departure from the norm, and there might be something in that, in fairness.
Yeah.
Or that people who are incredibly intelligent suffer for it because they can see things that other people can't see, which, you know, is sort of hand in hand with being really intelligent and sensitive and getting depressed.
Well, there is a statistic which shows that highly creative people, highly intelligent people are more likely to suffer from depression.
Yeah.
I think there definitely is. And I think also it links into the fact that highly intelligent people or highly creative people are more likely to get obsessed by something and are more likely to therefore have breakdowns of some sort.
Yeah, definitely.
I wanted to talk a little bit about, go back to, Dracula. Sorry.
Okay.
You heard my internal lament there, which is what happens whenever I forget anything, just the, I want to talk about Dracula, and I also want to talk about Richard Dadd, who was the artist that I mentioned before. So he was born in 1817, and he was his paintings really, really did focus on the supernatural. But also, he was very, very interested, in sort of the world beyond sort of the empire. So he was into the Orient and ancient Egypt and things like that, which was very popular at the time. Now, he, was crazy. I hope that's not offensive to say. He was it says, diagnosed to be of unsound mind after he basically he was convinced that his father was actually the devil, and he stabbed him to death before trying to escape to France, where he was caught because he tried to then stab a tourist whilst he was in France or on the boat on the way over. He confessed and he was taken to a Bethlehem psychiatric hospital, also known as Bedlam.
Yeah.
And he produced a lot of his work there, and a lot of his work was centered around fairies. Interestingly enough, the work that he did that centered around fairies, it was very busy. And when I say busy, I mean that if you look at his paintings, and you look him up, Richard Dadd, fairy paintings, his work is often very cluttered and clustered, and there's a lot of things going on in them, which seems to, you know, some people, you know, say that this was a reflection of kind of what he was feeling and how things were going for him, and the way that... the world felt clustered and confusing in his mind's eye. Now, the reason I bring that up and I want to compare it to Dracula is that you have Bram Stoker, who was an Irish writer. And I bring up the fact that he's Irish because when you look at the art of the time of people who came from Ireland or the north of England or from Scotland, the way that they treated the supernatural was different. And the way that Bram Stoker links in madness with the supernatural is very in keeping with those old traditional tales that linked the supernatural and madness together, and particularly had fairies. And this is, again, we're once more linking to the wildness of the unknown. That's why Dracula, you know, you went to sort of to Transylvania. It was because it was unknown. It was unruled by the sensibilities of the British Empire.
Yeah, there was no industrial revolution going on there, for example.
Exactly. So it was this unnaturalness. It was this, or rather, this supernaturalness, in that it was something even more ancient, which hadn't been colonized, which hadn't been controlled. And that was the root of madness, really, in all of them. In that you have lots of madness, as you say, Jules, popping up, and it's all caused by Dracula. And it's all caused by the isolation and the weirdness of what was going on.
Yeah, I'd say that's a fair statement about the whole thing. I mean, Dracula, I think, hit those early tropes before they were even recognised as tropes, didn't
yeah.
it? In the same sense of that eerie, is it happening, isn't it happening? I mean,
yes.
Clearly it is happening in Dracula, but then later artists like M.R. James, for example, with The Turn of the Screw, leave you still guessing at the end of the book whether it's actually happening or not.
Yeah.
You don't know. I mean, there's a point where you think, yeah, okay, this really is that weird, and then the author sort of retracts it again.
Yeah.
Which, again, is something that Sarah Waters does, and I've mentioned The Little Stranger before, and she does it in the traditional gothic ghost tropes in that as well. Yeah, so yeah, I'd agree with that as regards to Dracula, as this huge ancient natural force, a true monster, and coming up against that almost in a Lovecraftian way where your mind breaks under it.
Yeah.
Because exactly. Lovecraft madness is completely different, but yeah, feeds out of this, you've come up against something too big for mortal ken kind of thing.
Yeah. Now, moving on, sort of, not moving on, but as in growing from that, evolving from that, I want to sort of bring all of those elements in together and talk about madness and the world outside of Britain.
Okay.
And the way that those two things are linked. And they're particular, again, we see that a lot in Gothic fiction. Now, have you read, oh Lord, the accompanying novel, which was written much later on for Jane Eyre, which talks about
The Wide Sargasso Sea by Jean Rhys.
That's right. Okay.
Yes.
Now that is, I'm not sure, I can't remember, it's been so long since I've read Jane Eyre. So she was actually from one of the colonies, wasn't she? One of the colonies.
She was a Creole, so from Jamaica.
Yeah, so she was.
And she was born Antoinette Bertha Mason.
Yeah. So again, we have that relationship between foreign world, the strange world, and madness.
Yeah.
And we get it again in Dracula. Okay, so it appears in Wuthering Heights. It appears in, not Wuthering Heights, why do I keep saying Wuthering Heights? Sorry, these Bronte sisters, they're just swimming around in my head. So we get it in Jane Eyre. We get it in Dracula. I'm just trying to think of other examples.
The Moonstone by Wilkie Collins.
Okay, The Moonstone.
Because I was going to say, the Moonstone is a huge diamond which was stolen from an Indian shrine. And when the Moonstone is given to the heroine on her 18th birthday, that's when everything starts to go a bit wrong.
Yeah. And then again, the works of Richard Dadd, whose artwork was about fairies, and then the unknown, the uncolonized world, so Egypt and the Orient and things like that. and there's this odd link between them. The same for how even Shakespeare used fairies, and he used madness as well.
Yeah, Shakespeare's an interesting one, really, because when it's fairies in Shakespeare, it's temporary madness. When it's madness of a person, for example, King Lear is an excellent example. King Lear gives up. Basically, King Lear is all about not accepting sycophants.
Yeah.
And he causes a lot of his own problems for himself. But King Lear actually gives up his kingdom, thinking he can keep the name of king in name only. And his two elder daughters scheme against him. So he ends up going a bit nuts, crowning himself king of the wilderness. And it goes on from there. And it's very much like he's descending into something very much like an Alzheimer's state by that point.
Yeah.
Because he cannot cope with things. And that's also reflected in Ophelia, who, when it seems that Hamlet is rejecting her, she does that particular distance type of madness where she starts to lose track of herself as an independent person.
Yeah.
And what Shakespeare seems to be saying, and he's weirdly sympathetic in how he portrays it, is that madness is an affliction whereby the individual has an inability to adapt to traumatic change.
Yeah.
That's what it says to me.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you're right. It is really interesting how different artists have used madness and actually how their experiences and how the superstitions of the time have developed their understanding of what it means to be mad.
Yeah, I mean, I find it interesting what you were saying about the connection of nature and madness, because that's almost a complete reversal to 100 years before.
Yeah.
100 years before that, the four categories that a woman could be locked up for madness-wise were for being dissolute, because, you know, women were supposed to be modest and not drink and not have sex with everybody. to be not hopelessly depraved, so there's something wrong, but you're not considered a criminal.
Yeah.
Because being mad wouldn't necessarily save you from being hanged or executed if you'd done something criminal.
Yeah.
Condemned by order of the king, generally that meant that your political views were considered outside the norm, so you were considered mad if you were a woman and locked up for it. Or you might be withheld by order of the court, which is a case of you have behaved in a social way which was considered outside the norm, and therefore they have branded you mad for it. And under order of the court, that's a case of getting pregnant out of wedlock, for example.
Yeah.
So that's interesting. But the reason they tended to think those things happened was ultimately that women, children, and I hate to say this term, but this is literally what they said, lower races.
Yep.
Were less able to adapt to urbanisation. Therefore, removing them from the natural environment and from nature caused evolutionary regression, whereby they literally went backwards to a more primitive ape-like state.
Wow!
Which is really bad. And you didn't, until the 1870s, you didn't get the concept of the psyche, which was seen as something that could develop separately from the biological growth of an individual. And then obviously you go on from the idea of psyche. Psyche is actually the Greek word for soul or butterfly, mm-hmm. which I think is quite poetic. and from there, obviously, you have the beginning of psychology.
Yeah.
But that didn't happen until then. So all these disorders have actually been in existence for hundreds of years. And depending on the century, were not necessarily looked at with much sympathy because they weren't understood.
Yeah.
I think it's worth mentioning women and madness. And I'm going to go back to Wilkie Collins briefly again. I talked about the moonstone. The real case of madness in the moonstone is the servant who is obsessed with the young master, who is the hero of the piece. Mm. And you don't know. You don't know that's why she's acting strangely. You don't know that she thinks she's helping him conceal a murder, which he hasn't committed. She's just obsessed. He's kind to her once, and she comes from a slightly unstable, unhappy, abusive home life.
Mm-hmm.
She's spent time in prison for stealing and been given a new chance in this great house. And she's always a bit jumpy. I mean, you can imagine what possibly happened to her in prison, because they didn't necessarily separate men and women back then either.
Yeah.
So she's not in a good state. And she commits suicide by stepping into a peat bog. So it is clearly a very severe case of depression.
Mm.
Where she has obsessed about this person who, you know, one day when he's a bit distracted because he thinks he's going to be arrested, he sort of snaps at her, and she, from then, she spirals completely. He has no idea that she's in love with him.
Yeah.
And kills herself. And then if you look at the woman in white, you have poor Anne Catrick, who is the half-sister of Laura and Marion, and because she happens to possibly know the secret of the evil Earl and Count Fosco, they shut her up in a lunatic asylum and drug her with laudanum until she doesn't know herself, and drug her with laudanum and then push her off the top of a tower. So, you know, but people believe them over her because she's a woman. She doesn't have a man protecting her to speak for her.
Yeah.
And because she's always been a little bit sort of fey and quiet and, you know, not obviously logical, a bit sort of dreamy.
Yeah.
And, okay, Wilkie Collins is horribly timorous when he's writing about women. I mean, he wrote another book where he suggests that perhaps a woman who's a prostitute isn't inherently evil because she's trying to survive. And a lot of it is quite spineless, and I can't help being a bit scornful of how he writes them now, but at the time it was probably quite groundbreaking for a man to write it that way.
Yeah.
Whereas if you think of the utterly unsympathetic and ruthless light that Charlotte Bronte shines on Bertha Mason.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely.
As if succumbing to madness is that woman's fault.
Yeah. And that, yeah, she brought it upon herself. Which was very interesting, of course, considering Charlotte's own... how do we say? Life.
Yeah. What's interesting about the Brontes, and I have absolutely no evidence for this, by the way, except from my own reading and my own experiences,
mm-hmm.
are that we do think that Bramwell actually suffered from some form of epilepsy. And I personally think that both he and Charlotte, to a lesser extent, suffered from the same sort of epilepsy that I suffer from, which alters your perception of reality. Because it would explain the severe pain that Charlotte was in sometimes with her migraines.
Yeah.
And it would explain the strange way she had of looking at things, the almost fey sort of feeling, and the sort of almost being in a laudanum dream half the time.
Mm.
Because, in all fairness, without drugs to sort of alter how my brain works, that's kind of what it's like. And of course, Branwell had a much more severe form of epilepsy, which probably would have killed him ultimately. But it was much, and it's possible that he got hooked on laudanum because he was trying to control the severe headaches that come with temporal lobe epilepsy.
Yeah.
At least partially. I mean, a lot of what happened to him, he sort of did himself. He became obsessed about a married woman who he probably didn't have an affair with at all. It was all in his own head.
Yeah.
So it's not a case of abdicating responsibility, but I think it's really interesting. Probably just from a personal perspective. And as I said, I've got no evidence whatsoever.
No, and I think that actually we do need to consider the fact that there may have been creatives out there. Well, there were definitely creatives out there who suffered afflictions of these kind, which altered the way in which they wrote and they saw the world.
Yeah, Lewis Carroll, for example, and possibly Van Gogh as well.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's own. I suppose the thing is, I read the accounts of the symptoms and things they complained that they suffered, and I think, my God, that is so similar.
Yeah.
But I think if you haven't experienced it, it just sounds like, well, that sounds like schizophrenia to me.
Yeah.
And depression is one of the big symptoms of temporal lobe epilepsy. It's not something I particularly suffer from, luckily for me. But having a severe depression is part of it, which is why it has been sort of lumped in with mental illness.
Yeah. That's so really interesting. I've got, I've just seen the time. We're running out of time, but I feel like there's a whole other episode where we could just talk about madness in women and madness in creativity.
Yeah, it's a huge topic, and we haven't even touched on modern representations of mental illness, so we'll have to come back to it.
We will. I think the thing is that, talk about my pet peeve, and I've definitely mentioned it before, is the use of the word madness to incorporate anything which cannot be understood, and just say, and use it as a get out of jail free card.
Yeah.
Because the thing that I really, really want to stress is that when you are doing something which is caused by an altered mental state from the norm, if we imagine there's a parameter on the spectrum of what the norm is usually considered, it still makes sense to you. Now, I remember going through a short period of, you know, when I wasn't very well, with some of my problems and my anxiety and my depression, where I would do certain things which were actually a bit odd, you know, which were probably bordering on that level of, okay, that's a bit odd, in that someone could notice that I was doing these things. It couldn't just be put down to sort of relative kookiness.
Yeah.
Was I crazy? No. There was a perfectly logical reason for me doing these things, which was that at the time they put me at ease, and that in my head I said, if I do these things, I will feel better. So if I double check the locks, or tap my forehead when I leave the door, when I leave the house and I lock the door, I tap my forehead, and people will go, that just looks weird. But it's totally logical. The reason I tap my forehead is that I have a condition which affects my memory. But if I tap my forehead and add a physical feeling to the memory, I will remember the fact that I've locked the door.
Yeah.
So what really annoys me is when I see writing where it's just, they're like, and she did that. And I'm like, but why? What was the thought process behind that? Even if the thought process doesn't make sense, there will be an internal logic behind every action that we do. There is a cause and effect. And doing that, it sort of takes away what madness actually means. What is madness? And actually, the moment we do that is the moment we stop othering people who live on different levels of the spectrum of mental health, which is that most people are on that spectrum. The norm that we talk about is actually quite vast. Because we are now able to diagnose depression and anxiety and paranoia and understand that these are altered states of mind, and are not actually a person's natural state. They are caused by in chemical balances, etc., etc., etc. But the logic, there is still a reason behind the decisions that they are making.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, something they say in Dracula about Renfield, isn't it? Because he's eating progressively larger creatures in order to collect lives for the master. It's like there is method in his madness.
Yeah.
And ultimately, as you say, there will be things that people do either as coping mechanisms, or because they're following an internal logic that's consistent to them, or simply self-soothing methods.
Yeah.
For example, with obsessive compulsive disorder, the need to say, touch all the corners.
Exactly.
It looks strange if you don't inhabit that particular viewpoint, but actually it makes perfect sense to the person who does live there.
Exactly. I think we also need to separate the idea that people who exist within these states, or who are outside of that regular or the perceived norm, are dangerous. And I think that's what really annoys me, is when we sort of turn to the sort of, well, she stabbed him because she was mad. Well, yes. Anyone who goes around killing other people has definitely got something wrong with their brain, because we're not really geared to do that, if that makes sense.
No, we're sort of geared to do the absolute opposite of that, in fact, to try and look after each other, even when we don't like each other.
Exactly. So, yes, that is madness, but it's the idea that, well, people who are schizophrenic are more likely to be abused and in danger than they are to be dangerous to other people.
Yeah, absolutely. And I suppose this is part of the problem. As much as I love a good gothic novel, I even love the bad gothic novels, in fact, the inheritance of the gothic novel is that it's okay to say it's just madness.
Yeah.
You know? And it's filtered through into our current speculative fiction where, well, we might give it a bit more in terms of bells and whistles, and we might make the asylum scenes or the institution scenes a bit more lurid, but I still see writers today getting published by big five publishers where, you know, they have people being shut up in asylums. No one calls them asylums anymore. You know, in modern day, there's a good reason for that. There's a nasty stigma attached to the word asylum now. Asylum used to just be a shelter, but no, not anymore. And the fact that these things are still getting published and nobody's actually asking any questions about it,
yeah,
would suggest quite strongly that this is a chain of association that really does need to be broken now. And the Gothic novel, unfortunately, has left us with this as its inheritance.
Yeah, because during the time, madness was a form of entertainment.
It was a cheap and easy way to create villains or pitiable victims without delving too much into motivation, I think.
Yeah. Plus, you could have people visiting the asylums to see strange things.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Which, when you think about it, is really quite gross, isn't it?
It's incredibly gross. It's incredibly gross. And it just adds to our ability to other people who do not reflect us, when in reality, one in three people suffers from some form of mental illness of some kind, be it depression, anxiety. And most people will actually at least have a period of anxiety or depression in their lives. So,
yeah.
So there you go.
on that cheerful note.
That went somewhere quite deep. but
well, we won't visit madness again.
to end on something a little bit lighter, it's time for our Dissecting Dragons recommendation of the week. And this week, I'm going to be recommending the small animated series Over the Garden Wall. It is a very interesting series. It's a couple of years old now. It came out around the Halloween period. And it actually stars Elijah Wood in it, the gentleman who played Frodo in the famous Lord of the Rings trilogy. Films, not the actual books. I'm sorry. Over the Garden Wall is an episodic, very short episodes, with a sort of odd musical feel to them. It's very peculiar, and the first few episodes, actually, I really wasn't into it. I just thought, oh yeah, okay, well, I guess we'll sort of continue on. And it got very good very quickly. At first, I didn't understand what was going on, and then actually, I really, really enjoyed it. And the ending kind of blew me away. I really, really, really liked it. I highly recommend it. The episodes are all short, as so actually it's very easy to consume. And it's definitely something I would recommend you put on your to be watched list as we come into Halloween and stuff like that, because it's great watching. But it's on Netflix at the moment, so if you are interested, check it out. And as I say, stick with it till about the third episode. The episodes are short, so you can get through them very, very easily. And you will thank me later. And on that note, we will say thanks very much for listening, and we'll catch you guys next week.
Bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders, or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note, no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.